A Rayo Original Podcast.
When you've got a life's dream, you've got to make it happen. And if you've prepared enough and you've worked hard enough, then you will have that bit of luck and your dream can happen.
Today we're talking to someone who grew and sold his business for £4.1 billion.
It was one of those rare wow moments in life.
Richard Harpin took HomeServe from the brink of collapse to a multi-billion pound success with operations around the world.
Literally down to our last £10,000. They said, look, you've got to admit this is not going to work. And I knew that I'd find a way through.
We'll be learning about the characteristics that make someone a successful entrepreneur.
If you haven't got that resilience, persistence and courage, maybe entrepreneurship is not for you.
The failures that come as part of the journey to success.
We're taking a £110 million write-off.
And how it's not about the obstacles that get in your way, but the mindset you apply when facing those problems.
When there is darkness in the tunnel, you just need to persist. You need to be resilient. You need to keep going and you will find that light. I had to keep going, had to make it. Otherwise, my life would have been unfulfilled.
So, Richard, thank you so much for coming along. How are you?
I'm good. Do Tim call me Richard?
Are you sure?
I did think that a knighthood might get me a better table in a restaurant, and then I found out they make a surcharge.
But the wrong way, you don't want that anymore. But listen, I think it's incredibly proud. I hope you feel proud of being acknowledged in a certain way. Yes?
Yeah, it's one of those things where hopefully it will open more doors, help me to achieve more of my objectives. And but it made my mum really proud.
Amen. Well, as you can see, my mum's just above you, so that means a lot to me. I'm so interested in what you've got to let us know. But I really want to go back to a point. Listen, you're an entrepreneur, you're a father, you're a sexy dresser. I like the jacket that you're wearing today, right? But take me back to the day that you actually sold the company, because you started out humble beginnings to a 4.1 billion exit, Brookfields, your share price through the roof. What was that moment like?
It was one of those rare wow moments in life. And I thought, I can't believe that all of those struggles, nearly running out of money twice, taking a £50,000 investment back in Newcastle, business called A1 Fast Fix, on a 30-year journey. And everybody thinks it's easy, but actually, as you know, lots of bumps in the road and lots of mistakes. So to sort of get that, not the end, because it was just the closing of a chapter, but that a great Canadian investor, Brookfield, with $1 trillion under management, would come and buy HomeServe for £4.1 billion. It was a great moment.
So I love the marketing messages. I love the turnaround from the $1 trillion company, but I'm more interested in what that meant for you. Because let me make it clear, if somebody gave me £40, I'd be jumping up and down on the table, right? What was it like for you? Because you talk about the 30-year journey. What did it mean for you?
It meant that it was a closing of one chapter in my life and then the opening and opening up of the next. But I think I'm never one on self-congratulation. And the moment really felt like looking back and reflecting on all the mistakes that I'd made, but also the things that I'd learnt on that journey. The 9 things I know now that I wish I'd known at the start. And I think if I had, maybe as a team, we could have got there in 15 years rather than 30. Or we could have built a business that was twice as big in 20 countries and with 20,000 people. So that was the important bit, was to take out the learning for the next stage of my journey.
So did you not celebrate in any way? Did you not buy a bottle of champagne? What was the thing when the actual deal, the due diligence is completed?
I did have a big party for 200 people, flew in some of the teams from my HomeServe around the world to celebrate, all my family and friends over the years, and in Yorkshire, because that is my, that's where I was born, that's where my roots are. And It was a multiple party because I thought I'll celebrate my 60th birthday early because that feels really old. So far better to celebrate it at 59. We'll celebrate the amazing sale of HomeServe and also the 30th anniversary of the business. And one of the things that I didn't want to do was to take all the money that I'd made that ended up in my bank account January the 9th in 2023. And that was a sort of big occasion to see that. But it wasn't so much about that. It was saying HomeServe was my baby, still is. And I want to make sure that it continues to go on and be really successful, that Brookfield benefit from their ownership. So I didn't too much want to celebrate sort of the ends, but the new chapter for HomeServe and for my next career.
A good friend of mine, Dean Forbes, he sold a business for $1 billion. And he said, after the moment of being ecstatic at reaching a milestone, he actually had a lot of responsibility because it was about what the impact it was going to have on other people's lives. That seems similar for you.
I think there's a lot of people that sell a business and they have seller's remorse. And so I'd sort of planned a bit over the period from when I was sitting in Checkatrade in Portsmouth. My phone bleeped, share price up 15%. Brookfield are in the early stages of making an offer for HomeServe. They had to put out that stock exchange mm-hmm. announcement. And so from there to the actual sale was the best part of a year.
Wow.
So I did have time to sort of reflect on what I was going to do next. And my advice for anybody that's selling a business is think before you've sold it what you're going to do next, because you might go to the beach for a month and then be bored in the way that I certainly would be.
You went to the beach?
Only for a couple of weeks. And but I planned out sort of quite a bit before what was my only skill and how was I going to use that. And I'm a bit slow on the uptake. I had to go to Harvard Business School for 3 days
yep.
to work out what my career objective should be post-HomeServe. And all these people came up with these sort of long statements and big plans. Mm. And I came up with two words.
Which were?
But those words were inspire breakthrough. And I hope if you went to any of the 10 chief execs in HomeServe that ran each of the countries, mm-hmm. they were the ones that made it happen and said, what was my part in that? Hopefully they would say, I challenged them and I inspired them. And as a team, we delivered more than we ever dreamt of.
So how do you inspire people who are running a big company with P&Ls and responsibilities, et cetera, to keep going when you know your destination is to get to an exit point for $4.1 billion?
Yeah, I think have a great business with a really good culture, which is customer focused. Have a very tight operating model, which we did in each country for HomeServe. And it was very similar between America and Germany and Spain and the UK.
So you get the same level of service wherever
yes,
you are.
But hire great chief execs and give them the autonomy to hire their team and run their business.
And then manage them on the results, not on what they are in those situations.
Yeah, not on the day-to-day micromanaging. It's saying, this is now your business, you're the leader of it, you run it to this framework, but you make the decisions within that. And I think that was really empowering for the team.
So if you entrust those chief execs to be great at what they're doing, what did you say you're great at? What was your skill?
Inspiring them, hiring great chief execs that were a lot better at running the day-to-day than I was. And that was probably, if you boil down the success of HomeServe, I would think it was really identifying that I was a rubbish chief exec, not interested in running the day-to-day, and hiring people that were proven chief execs that could run each of the countries better than me. And then saying, would HomeServe work in another country? And proving out the international playbook and then opening up in 9 other territories.
Because that's really interesting for me, because there's lots of people who will be watching this who are on their entrepreneurial journey or they're in a management position and they think they have to do everything and they have to be great at everything. But you identified early what you weren't so good at and got out of the way of yourself. Where did that come from? Did you have to be told to do it? Or did you just naturally know that was the case?
I remember sort of over the years having performance reviews with my chairman. And the chairman changed a few times over the years. And we enforced those twice a year performance reviews. And I remember always coming out of those feeling miserable that I'd only got a couple of strengths and I'd got loads of areas for improvement. Mm-hmm. And then I had a breakthrough. I learned that actually if we all just focus on our one or two big strengths and hire people to do the things that we don't like doing, that we're not good at, that is the magic model.
Amen. That's true. But listen, I'm chair of a school board, the old school that I went to, the same school that excluded me. And I'm so frustrated. We still have an education system that is focused on making people great at everything rather than focusing on their one or two strengths and then doubling down on that.
Yeah, focus on your passion. Work out what it is and then go for it.
I love that. So that's good. So a lot of us focus on the destination, like getting to the end point, exiting the company. When you are at that particular point, you assume that it's going to bring you happiness. Did the 4.1 billion bring you happiness?
It brought me some credentials to say that I've done it. It brought me, most of all, the lessons on how do you do it, and then said, I need to take my career purpose of inspiring breakthrough and help other entrepreneurs at an earlier stage in their journey.
So the exit didn't make you happy?
So, it did, and I thought, wow, that was a great moment. I've got money that gives me freedom in life. I can invest that in other entrepreneurs, set up Business Leader as an organization to help scale ups to grow. Mm-hmm. And it was great. But the other bit was, I believe in evolution, not revolution. And I didn't want to walk away from HomeServe with all that money and leave the team. So for a period of 2 years, I did stay on and move from founder and group chief exec to non-exec chairman.
So you still had a responsibility to the team, you felt?
And yeah, that just gave me that sort of a bit of continuity and for the team. And I think that was quite important. If you go from working flat out to then doing nothing, I think you can end up with that seller's remorse.
Mm. And did you have that?
No, because I'd worked out what I was going to do. I stayed and did the chair role. I learned from that. I'm a great believer in learning and training. And so I went and did trained as a business coach at INSEAD. Mm. 10 days over 6 months. And I thought it's going to be really difficult for my team and for me in going from a hands-on entrepreneurial founder to non-exec chairman. And if I train as a business coach, that will help me a bit in terms of stepping back and taking more of a coaching role rather than a very directive role.
Have you always been this strategic in your thought process? Because most people, when they're running a business the size and scale of HomeServe, aren't thinking about, okay, what's the transitionary phase? How do I make sure I don't get the seller's remorse? They're just thinking, I've got to run 100 miles to do this and manage all these different things. Have you always been quite strategic in everything that you've done?
I think I've learned over the years. And if I was looking back and said, what advice would I have given myself? Then it would be to say that plan out your year on a page. And do it over the Christmas period. And you've got to set out, first of all, starting with what's your purpose? Whether you're running a business, whether you're developing a career, whether you want to be successful in a non-business field, it is about saying, what's your purpose? how are you unique and different to somebody else? And then write it down on a page. And I think we're also focused in the early days of running a business or with a career that we're really, really busy. We're focusing on the urgent and the important, but we're not focusing on the important and not urgent. And that's the crown jewels of how people make it. You've got to free up a bit of your time for the thinking and for the strategy and checking that you are delivering your purpose and that you're achieving your plans.
I'm not trying to be everything to everybody, right? You can't do it. It's impossible. So you mentioned before that you, if you could tell your younger self, you might have done better with the sale. You could have done more with the sale. Does that give you the indication that you weren't 100% happy with what you got in terms of the valuation?
No, I was really happy with this. But I was on stage at the Business Leader Summit a few months ago in London, 800 founders and entrepreneurs in the audience. Mm. And I was talking about my How to Make a Billion in 9 Steps, but not using HomeServe as the case study. I'd picked out other businesses that were more successful than HomeServe.
Yep.
And I was standing there feeling inadequate that surely I could have built a business with my great team that could have been worth even more, created even more jobs. And I use the example of Belron, also glass in the UK. That was a business that went from a value of 200 million euros in the year 2000 to 24 billion in 2023. And so I still want to learn. And I still want to build more billion-pound businesses, ideally some that are worth 10 billion.
Yep.
But that won't be me building them. It won't be me as the chief exec. I want to help others to do it.
So you still want to get the buzz of creating stuff, creating jobs and opportunities, but you want to advise now from a position of having done it before and having the resources to invest in that next stage.
Exactly. Helping those entrepreneurs to avoid the mistakes I made, follow my model for how you build a billion-pound business. And even if some of them don't get there, and that's a sort of, it's a big goal, isn't it? But my message for anybody out there, Tim, is you don't need to get to the billion, aspire to something big, and just go for it. And if you really believe in yourself and you hone those characteristics that are important to get there, you will achieve it.
So what do you think are the things that people should be focusing on for the next stage of their businesses, the industry sectors that could potentially have that billion-dollar opportunity?
Yeah, I think there are opportunities in many, many sectors. I'm focused in my investment business, Growth Partner, in HomeServe-like businesses. So where's the next Autoglass or HomeServe or Rentokil? Not competing with any of those, but finding the next niche, which could be a service and depot-based business.
Yep.
Big opportunities in health and longevity, and I think that's a really exciting area. Mm. And what I would call consumer 3.0,
which is
sort of a membership and service-based retail model, not just selling an individual product.
Or direct-to-customer stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and by doing it in an omni-channel way.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of businesses online, but right now it's about saying, have stores or pop-ups or sell your products in other people's stores as well as being online. And I think the omni-channel model is really, really important.
One of the biggest pulls around entrepreneurship we've done from our research is that people want to change their life through the money that they will make, right? I want you to take us to that point where you'd clocked life, basically. You've got all the money that you could ever imagine, right? Firstly, what was the biggest thing that you bought with that first big successful bit of money? And did the money actually change you for the better or worse?
Yeah, I the big event really was in 2010,
yep.
when I sold a chunk of my HomeServe shares. We'd been a listed company then for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
We'd outgrown our parent water company and we demerged HomeServe and listed it on the stock market at a £300 million valuation in 2004. All of my friends and colleagues said, sell some shares, bank some money, de-risk. What if it all goes wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And I ignored them. And I went out and borrowed $20 million secured on my HomeServe listed shares and only was persuaded in 2010, where I paid off my debt and ended up with, I think, sort of $45 million mm-hmm. after I'd repaid that $20 million of borrowings before I paid tax on it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was more than enough to secure the future of my family forevermore. So it was never about going out and sort of buying the big thing.
Yep.
I think it was that feeling of freedom and providing choices. And it was also about de-risking. So I think my advice today to anybody would be do have a de-risk event
yep.
where you know that if it did ever go wrong, you're not going to be on the street. That you've banked some money, that maybe you have gone and bought your holiday villa or ski chalet or whatever appeals to you. And then you can press the accelerate button and go faster. And if you can find the right investor that will help you to de-risk and give you some growth capital, I think that's a really good thing to do.
Mm.
So I think that event in 2010 did help me to say, right, let's really get on with it.
Because then you didn't have to worry about the lower Maslow needs. You could then start focusing on getting to the position of driving the business 100% without worrying about the roof over your head or the food in the fridge. Is that right?
Yeah. And then when you have made it, money goes from becoming a goal and the output of your efforts to the input.
Mm.
So I now say that I've got money that I can put into helping youth enterprise, helping businesses to scale. And I made a really big personal investment in Business Leader, the organization that provides coaching and provides peer groups and a growth program and building a great team there. And I'm not doing it because I want to make more money. I'm doing it for that purpose of inspiring breakthrough, but it is a for-profit business because actually there's nothing wrong with that. Nobody should worry about running a business to make money because you can still have one that does that, but has a really important purpose.
I truly believe. I think there's so many people who think that you can only do good through charities, but actually charities look for surplus. They just call profit a different name, right?
Yeah.
So why can't you do it through a for-profit business? Because I believe creating jobs is a good thing. Making sure that you can solve people's problems. These are all societal beneficial things that come from running a perfectly successful enterprise.
And because if you're bringing in the very best people, they will be motivated by wanting to make some money as well as delivering a purpose. So I think running a for-profit organization is actually easier than a not-for-profit or a charity.
I agree 100%. So you've always said, and I've seen from the list of things that you've continued to do after the exit, that you're never going to retire. Most people are desperate to just kick up their feet, sit on the beach in our budgie smugglers, as it were, and then do nothing else. But you said you're never going to do that. Why?
Because I've got a passion for business and I enjoy it every day. I do think now it is about getting more work-life balance than I had certainly in the early days of HomeServe. And I think it's very difficult then.
Mm.
And so I can now choose to have a few more holidays, to have the occasional Friday that is thinking time and doing interesting visits.
Mm-hmm.
But I really love work. But most importantly, I want to sit with some of those founders and CEOs in 5 or 10 years' time and say, look what you've achieved. And all I did was help you to avoid the mistakes that I made. Maybe I put some of my capital into taking a minority investment in your business, and you've made it. So it's that. That's the feeling in your heart that says, look at those people that made it. Like the ones that we talked about before we started filming this morning, Tim, on those businesses you helped. The hairdresser that went on to open 3 salons and made a big success of it.
The only reason I do those things or create platforms is because I'm a people pleaser. I wanted to please my mum by getting good exam results, and I was happy when she was happy with me. And that's carried on through everything I've gone on to do. Because I think people say that money is the root of all evil. I don't believe that. I think money amplifies the person that was already there. So if you were a bad person, you'd be a worse person with more money. And if you're a good person, you end up being a philanthropist and investing in the next stage like you have, right?
I think so. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So lots of people that must be sending you business plans all the time and telling you all this. What are the ones that are most exciting? Not specific businesses, but areas of business that are most interesting for you at the moment?
Yeah, these have got to be businesses that are making between 1 and 5 million of EBITDA profit today.
So not turnover, actual,
Actual profit. Yep. They've got a model that is proven. And then it's about how can we help them to scale bigger and faster.
So industry agnostic, you don't mind where they come from?
Tech, but that would be avoiding the sort of direct AI businesses because the Americans know more about those or some very big operations. So it's picking areas where we've got expertise around consumer, around services, and fitness and leisure.
Okay.
So a business that we just exited called Synergym. That was a copy of Pure Gym. It was an ex-HomeServe colleague that was a regretted loss. Met him at the HomeServe Alumni Club. And I said, what are you up to now? And Len said, we copied Pure Gym. That's my step number one, copy and pivot. So my ears pricked up and I thought...
tell me more.
he said, low-cost gyms haven't been done in a big way in Spain.
Yep.
We've set one up. It's called Synergym. We've got 12 gyms open. We're looking for an investor to put in 6 million euros for 20%. And we just sold that business 5.5 years later with 160 gyms. They're opening a new gym every 6 days. And we got a great financial return on that. But more importantly, it was sitting and celebrating with the two founders to say, you made it big. All I did was believe in you, gave you a little bit of capital, a small amount of guidance, but it was the two of you that made it happen.
I don't want to make it seem like it's all roses, though. You talked about some of the bumps along the journey. I want you to take us back to the worst bump, the time when you felt completely out of your depth, when you weren't too sure that the £50,000 was going to turn into anything. What was that moment like? What was happening? And how did you navigate that?
Yeah, there was a common theme, and that was I was overambitious, looking to grow HomeServe in too many directions at the same time. And we've got a great business model. Utility branded home assistance cover, annual payment, subscription model.
Brilliant.
Great customer service, high retention.
Regular income.
And so why on earth did I say, let's go and get into furniture warranties for furniture retailers? Why did I say, let's go and do low margin repairs for home insurers when people have a fire or a flood or a break-in? And why should we get into smart home devices? Those are all two steps removed from what we were currently doing.
Yep.
So what I should have done is focused a lot more on the core model and said no, had a not to do list. So one of the biggest bumps was I'd gone and spent 130 million mm-hmm. of shareholders' money mm-hmm. on buying a series of businesses that were doing repairs for home insurers. Along came e-tendering, and the margins came down. Other businesses were competing for that work from big insurers like Aviva. And we saw millions wiped off our profit in the space of a 45-minute online e-tender auction.
All off the back of one of your decisions?
Yeah, spending 130 million. And so I hope I'm an honest sort of person, and I said, we've got to go and get out of these businesses and sell them. We've got to put our hands up and say to our shareholders and to the stock market, I'm really, really sorry. Mm. I shouldn't have bought all those businesses. Mm. And so the day in 2009, when we put out an announcement to say we're out of the home repairs for insurers, we've just sold the businesses for 20 million that we bought for 130 million. We're taking a 110 million pound write-off. I said, I'm really sorry. And guess what happened?
What happened?
Share price on the day went up by 250 million pounds. And why? Because we got out of them proactively. We admitted my mistake. And we focused back on our core magic model of home assistance. So you can get that the lesson is anybody that thinks that entrepreneurship is, well, you set up a business mm-hmm. and the next day you sell it for 4 billion. Well, that is not the reality. Mm-hmm. You said not everybody can be an entrepreneur. I do think that you can train and hone some of your personal characteristics. But ultimately, if you haven't got that resilience and persistence and curiosity and courage and low ego and focus on the growth of the business, not the growth of your own career, then maybe entrepreneurship is not for you.
And I think that's why you're one of the few who has done the things you have, because that's a very rare combination. That mix and recipe you just talked about does not exist in many people, right? And you had to go on the journey yourself. You, one of your non-execs, Stella David, she said she read the early draft of the book, right? And she said clearly that lots of other people had paid the price of the ambition, the decisions that you've just thankfully articulated in such a beautiful way. But the staff who left after a year, the arguments, the disruption, that's part of a business culture sometimes. These things had to happen. But you had to admit that you had to smooth that all over to get the business to grow to the scale it was. What did her feedback as a non-exec make you see?
Yeah, I learned that feedback from my chairman and non-execs was really important. And I was actually, my very first chairman, a guy called Lindsay Berry, mm-hmm. wrote his memoir and I read it, and he very kindly called me an entrepreneur of genius, which I don't think is quite true, but I'll take it.
You're not going to argue yet?
But then he wrote, HomeServe was doing so well that we didn't challenge Richard on stopping him from going and buying the furniture warranty business and the repair businesses for home insurers. And when I read that, I was genuinely horrified.
Why?
Because they should have challenged me. They should have said, stick to your core business. Don't go and buy those businesses.
Would you have listened?
They knew that we shouldn't have done. And they were right. And ultimately, it turned out that I was wrong. And I'd have been pissed off for a couple of days, but then I'd have seen sense and I would have got on with it. So one of the things I've learned is you need to listen to your non-execs and your chair. Any business should have one or two non-execs or a chairman. They're almost you. You buy a non-exec and you get a mentor mm-hmm. for free. But if you're going to do that, then you've got to listen to them. And I do today. I think having mentors is really important. And I look back and wish I'd listened a bit more.
See, it's important to have a check and balance, but it's also important to have the humility to understand that people know more than you do. Because at the top of the tree, you're surrounded by lots of people who just want to say yes. So you need someone who's sometimes going to say no.
And that danger, the bigger that you become and the more successful you become, it's even more difficult for people to say, no, that's a stupid idea. So it's really important to have humility and to show your mistakes and to always demonstrate that I want to hear Stuart Machin, the chief exec of M&S, doing a great job there. He would call it confronting the unvarnished truth.
So Paul said, well, the team here have no problem telling me I'm an idiot, so we don't know about that, right? So that's fine. But your book, you've mentioned it several times. Thank you for sharing it. And it's a brilliant thing. Going through all the chapters, the one that sticks out most to me is step 9 in the process, which I'm not going to test you on what it is because you wrote it, but it's about honing your character. And the thing that's come across wonderfully powerfully from you is about how important character is in individuals. Tell me and the people watching, what are some of the characteristics that you think that a person has to have, not to make a billion, because not everyone will do, but to be successful?
Yeah, the three behaviours and values that I really believe in are persistence. And things don't come easy, but if you're really determined, then you can make stuff happen. People will say no to a business proposition and eventually they can be persuaded. And many people give up when you need to keep going and you can eventually make it happen. And the second one would be courage. And that's about having the courage of your convictions. And there was a really great business that I found called Checkatrade back in 2016. And we ended up buying the business as the way to evolve HomeServe and paid an awful lot of money for it. And I had the courage to go to my board and say, we want to pay a ridiculous amount of money to buy the business. It was only making £1 million profit at the time. I had the courage to ask. And on that occasion, they had the courage to back my recommendation. And Checkatrade today is a fantastic business, marketplace for trades. It's helping those trades to grow. It will be one of those next £1 billion UK success stories. But we paid a lot of money for it at the time. And so courage. The third one would be integrity. And by that, I don't mean honesty, because hopefully most people in business are honest, but I would call it confronting the brutal facts, having those honest conversations and debates and addressing the thing that needs to be tackled in the business.
So many people avoid the hard things, don't they?
And very often that will be a people issue. How many people out there listening employ somebody that the business has outgrown, that really shouldn't be in the business anymore, that person helped on the journey, will be successful elsewhere, but they need to get on and tackle that right now, have that kind conversation, but need to get on with this. So that would be an example of confronting the brutal fact and exiting somebody in the right way and hiring somebody that can take the business forward. Even anybody that is listening to this and they're not the entrepreneur, they work for an employer. Again, it is about confronting those brutal facts of the day-to-day job and having that courage to make a simple change that could make the difference.
Amen. I think that's very important. But going through the steps, most people will be cautious, because if it's as simple as following 9 steps, why doesn't everybody do it, right? So the question is it about a process, or is it about being in the right place at the right time? Is it a bit more luck than it is about planning?
I do believe in luck, but luck only comes from preparation mm-hmm. and hard work. It's when preparation and hard work meets opportunity. I did have a very lucky moment when HomeServe had nearly run out of cash for the second time.
Wow.
We'd burnt through the £500,000 that South Staffs Water put into the business, mm-hmm. literally down to our last £10,000. And there were 23 people in the business. All knew that they're about to be made redundant. The water company were going to shut down the business.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody called me and said, there's a little water company in Surrey and they've developed plumbing insurance. I got in my car, drove down to Surrey and interviewed some people on the street that had bought the product, copied it, improved it, and that became the HomeServe model. That was a stroke of luck. And even my business partner had come to me and said, Richard, your life dream from the age of four, when you saw Lord Hanson's helicopter land in the in the garden of the big house at the end of the cul-de-sac in Huddersfield, where I was born, that dream of being a successful entrepreneur is over.
Wow.
You've run out of luck. You've run out of money twice. You better go back and work for Procter & Gamble. And you know what? When you've got a life's dream, you've got to make it happen. And if you've prepared enough and you've worked hard enough, then you will have that bit of luck and your dream can happen.
So at no point did you ever believe that it wasn't going to happen?
No. I had to keep going, had to make it. Otherwise, my life would have been unfulfilled.
So there's no choice. There was no other option. You had to do it.
Yeah.
The people you were crazy.
Yeah. They said, look, you've got to admit this is not going to work. And I knew that I'd find a way through. When there is darkness in the tunnel, that you just need to persist. You need to be resilient. You need to keep going and you will find that light. But it may be that you need to copy. You need to pivot. You need to drop an idea and just sort of change it.
Mm.
You shouldn't doggedly go on determinedly. If you haven't got the right idea, you need to be open to copying somebody else's model, pivoting, doing market research until you find the way through.
Have you always been like that since you were a four-year-old watching a helicopter? Just dogged determined?
Yeah, and my apprenticeship was selling white rabbits to my school friends age five, running a rabbit kennels, becoming a children's magician.
Treats, you're selling rabbits. How did you do that?
When I left Huddersfield, when my dad got promoted in the civil service and we moved to Newcastle,
mm-hmm.
then my grandfather gave me a white rabbit as a leaving present. And I'd been inspired by Lord Hanson and his helicopter mm-hmm. and said, I want one of those one day. And so I thought I need to start running a business and making money and buying a second rabbit and breeding them and selling the offspring was that first business.
I love this. You literally bought two rabbits, had them in a cage and then were selling whatever came out.
But then you got a one-off sale. I then need to figure out how do I make money out of those friends and figured out that they go on holiday once a year. And they can bring the rabbit to me and I'll run a rabbit kennels and make more money from looking after the rabbit for 2 weeks than I did selling them the rabbit in the first place.
And what was your home like at the moment? Were your parents supportive of all this whole endeavour?
We got some outbuildings and got some wire cages on these old hospital bed stands and that was the rabbit kennels.
So how much were you selling a rabbit for?
I think it was about 25p at the time. I remember when I was 9 years old, then doing two children's birthday parties, doing a 30-minute magic show. That was 50p.
Wow, so you're renting out the rabbits now.
But that was three times what my weekly pocket money at the time was.
And how much was you charging to store and keep the rabbits?
I can't honestly remember, but I think it was more than I sold the rabbit for in the first place.
So immediately you're thinking about a lifetime value of a customer at 4 or 5 years of age. You are a genius.
Far from it.
But anyway, I'm impressed with that. I like that. So you've already mentioned about young people and the next generation. So that person who is now 14, they're not four anymore, they're 14, they're thinking about careers. You're a great advocate of apprenticeships. Why is that important for you?
Because it's learning a skill. Mm. It's an alternative to going and doing a degree and taking on a lot of student debt. So I think we need more apprenticeships in the UK. The apprentice numbers are declining rather than growing, and we've got to turn that around. We need more of those technical skills in this country. Mm. But equally, going and setting up a business. But if you said, is there a magic age for doing that? Then the average age that people start a business is, and I was surprised by this, is 42 years old. What that says is people have worked for somebody else. They have learnt. I can't underestimate the 3.5 years that I did at Procter & Gamble in marketing, learning about marketing. I was the brand assistant on Fairy Liquid, which is why my hands are still so soft. learning every day, learning marketing, learning how to run a business. Mm. So if you said, what's the right age? Ideally, you'd have worked for somebody else, but you do it before you take on a big mortgage.
Yep.
You have kids, and therefore you've got time and money to try and get the business off the ground before you have those other responsibilities.
Love it. Talking of responsibilities, right? I want to read you something, because the 9 chapters are really important, but I want to read something to you. It's the dedication in your book, right? It says, to my children, for the days I didn't always make it home for bedtime and to Kate for bringing them up so well, to my mother and brother for helping with the early business ventures, and to everyone who has worked at HomeServe for your hard work and commitment in building an amazing business. Why did you make that the dedication of your book?
Because it was all the people around me that that helped. And because I had to make sacrifices in my early family life. I wasn't there for tea time every day. I would leave the house at 5:25 every morning, so I'd never see the kids get up and have breakfast. Do I look back and regret that? No, because my kids saw me work really hard. They are not privileged kids that take money for granted. They're all working really hard in life and very proud of them. And the only thing I can do now is say, I don't buy them material gifts. Mm. I buy them experiences.
Mm.
And so it's making up for time by doing stuff with them. So
I know with my children, so I've had to make equal sacrifices. Just yesterday, my son is preparing to go for a karate competition in Poland. He'll be competing for a national company in Poland. But I know I've got a very important meeting with a financier that I can't cancel. I don't regret it because I know what the investment is. But I also know that work-life balance doesn't exist, because I have to do that because of the things I'm responsible for as a father. Are there things that you have in a similar way that you regret or wish you had changed in your journey?
Yeah, there was one occasion where I thought I must be at parents' evening at school in York. And my business...
You went to university, yes?
My business was based north of Birmingham. And the only way that I could make that parents' evening was getting permission from the school to land my helicopter on the school playing fields. And I wish I hadn't done it. I did make parents' evening, but my kids were horrified. They didn't want their friends to know that their dad had a helicopter that was far too flash. Yeah. And so that's a wish that I hadn't made it to parents' evening.
At least it's not in the helicopter. I can imagine the conversations the next day for them would have been quite interesting, right? But you were definitely remembered. Everything will be forgotten, right? So Do you look back and wish you could change anything along the journey with regards to family?
No, I don't. No, I think had a great family life, got three amazing kids.
Amen.
We do a lot together. Amen. They're really sporty. Yeah. I wasn't sporty in early life. As I've got older, I've freed up more time.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I have the most time now, even though still working full time. But my challenge this year is half Ironman triathlon.
Wow.
With all three of my kids. They're,
and you want to beat them, don't
21,
you?
21, 24 and 26. Yeah. And I'm reconciled to coming fourth. I want to try and just finish it.
Yep.
And be there in Berlin in middle of September, taking part with them.
God bless you. I wish you the best of luck. I hope you win as well, because that would be quite good at the tea table, right? But here's a tension I can't get past, right? Your advice to young entrepreneurs specifically is to pour all of their time and effort into the work they do, because as an investor, as a business owner yourself, you know that is incredibly important to make something work. But then the thing that you regret is exactly the things that you have to let go because you're pouring in 100%. So which is it? What do you actually think the person who's going to make it needs to do?
If you want to have a balanced life between family, friends, leisure and work,
mm-hmm.
then I'd recommend that you stay as an employee and that you you don't take the risk and the sacrifices of being an entrepreneur. Even as a chief exec, if you're a paid chief exec, then not always easy to get that work-life balance. And particularly for entrepreneurs in the founders phase, that phase, which might be the first 5 to 7 years of figuring out the business, getting the right model, scaling it, bringing in the right people, then you're not going to get that that balance in life, and you've just got to suck it up. Then you should follow the advice of hiring your replacement,
yep.
bringing in a proven chief exec. That doesn't mean you're leaving the business, but you're working on the business rather than in it, working out what your role should be. And that's the time that you could then start saying, I can get a bit more balance. I can spend a bit more time on friends and family.
You talk very passionately about frameworks and processes. It's quite a strategic way that you apply decisions to be made and actions you take as a result. What's the key frameworks that have formed your success, you think? And what are the ones that you advise aspiring entrepreneurs to follow to be successful?
I think it is having that one-page vision and strategy and plan for a year. Not put too much on it, but you've got to have that personal plan on what you want to achieve. And then write down what your disappointments were, what your achievements were, and what you learned, and go again for the following year. Applying that same principle in business is about knowing what are the key performance indicators that you and your team need to look at every week and every month. Having that weekly management meeting where you're together for an hour and you're discussing the business performance, what happened last week, what are you going to do, what are you going to change? That's the sort of the modus operandi for the business.
So making sure that you've got metrics which measure what's actually moving, and then being, to your point, courageous enough to acknowledge that they might not be going in the right direction and fix those.
Exactly.
Like, see, I'm listening. You see, I do listen. So final question for me. Someone listening to this right now, where they are in their journey before anything's worked out, they're at the beginning starting. What's your advice that you would have given to yourself at that very early stage? You've gone past selling rabbits for magic shows and you've just started your business. What are you advising someone to do?
I would find a role model. Who's the person that you want to be like and you want to copy? And that might just be a career. If you're in your 20s and you're thinking, well, I don't want to be an entrepreneur, but I do want to be a paid chief exec,
yep.
then find some role models. Go onto LinkedIn and find those people. and then use one of those life skills of persistence and track that person down and try and persuade them to be your mentor. So that would be my bit of advice.
Love it. Carbon copy and then put your own little spin on it. So Richard, it's been an amazing conversation, but I just want to finish out with some quick fire closing questions. So I want to focus more on the courageous integrity side of your three, but I'm going to be persistent in getting through the following six questions. So I just want to say the first thing that comes into your mind, don't overthink it, just go with it, right? If you had to restart tomorrow with nothing, what would you do?
I would buy a business rather than set one up, and I would buy it with vendor finance, borrow the money from the person that is selling it. That is lower risk, and you've got a starting point.
Love that. So don't have to start from scratch because everyone believes they have to create something new. Okay, good. What's one aspect of your career that you would redo?
Yeah, the one aspect of my career that I'd redo would be staying more focused, not going and doing acquisitions that were two steps removed from what we were currently doing. So it's having that not to do list and being much more disciplined.
So no trips to Brazil.
Exactly.
What's one core belief that you've had to reconsider?
That it's not about the idea. How many people do we hear that say, oh, I had a great business idea, but then I researched it and somebody else had done it, so I didn't do it? Because actually, if somebody's already doing it, that's a tick. That's great. All you need to do is just do it a bit better. So it's, you don't need a big original idea.
I love that. Final question for me. What do you still have left to rework?
Is helping create the next 7,500 large companies through inspiring breakthrough from my growth program. And that's the big bit of focus for me and the business leader team over the next 3 to 5 years.
So Richard, it's been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Tim.
God bless you. What a brilliant conversation we just had with Sir Richard. Here are the three things that I want you to take away from our conversation. The first one, which really stuck with me, said, you don't have to see the end, you just have to believe in it. All too often, many of us don't know the destination and where we want to end up, but we have to have the confidence that we're going in the right direction. The next thing he talked about was, don't be afraid to own your mistakes. That's incredibly important because you're going to make them, but just acknowledge what they are, own them, and then the benefits could be, like him, 250 million. The final one was the one that really, really landed with me. He said the three key personality traits that you need to be successful are perseverance, courage, and importantly, integrity. If something from this episode resonated with you, please share it with someone that you know who wants to rework their career or their life. And don't forget to like and subscribe for more conversations just like this one. See you next time.
This was a Rayo Original Podcast.